Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in. We'll also be joined by Ann Kinzel, our other host, and we'll be covering a variety of topics this hour, ranging from philanthropy to food security to federal funds and how to use them locally to help out in hard times. So stay with us. We're glad to have you here. I don't know about you, but I've been thinking over the mask situation when I'm out of the house. I came across something on the subject on Facebook offered by John Murphy, who's a wonderful colleague in the community radio world in the East Coast. He used to be the station manager of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. I don't know if John wrote this himself, but he's obviously been thinking about the social dynamics around masks. So here are the thoughts that he has passed on. When I wear a mask in public, I want you to know that I'm educated enough to know that I could be asymptomatic and still give you the virus. I don't, quote, live in fear, unquote. I just want to be part of the solution, not the problem. The, quote, government isn't controlling me, unquote. I'm being an adult contributing to society. The world doesn't revolve around me. It's not all about me and my comfort. Wearing a mask doesn't make me weak. It makes me considerate. And when you think about how you look, how uncomfortable it is, or what others think of you, just imagine someone close to you, a child, a father, a mother, grandparent, aunt, or uncle, choking on a respirator, alone without you or any family member allowed at the bedside. Ask yourself if you could have sucked it up a little bit more for them. So thanks, John Murphy, for passing these thoughts on, and whoever else has contributed to these thoughts. Wearing a mask is an act of caring. It does not protect the person wearing the mask from the virus, but it does help the mask wearer keep from spreading the virus to others. So it's really done as an act to protect others. And speaking of generosity, I'd like to welcome Charlie Weber. Thanks for joining us. Charlie Weber is with the Good Neighbor Emergency Assistance, which is one of the 16 nonprofit organizations that make up the Story County Alliance for Philanthropy, which is having an annual event this year. And our own Anna Banana, who is actually Anna Magnuson, is another member of the Alliance for Philanthropy as the director of Iowa ABLE. Online, the Story County Alliance for Philanthropy says that it's interested in showing appreciation for all that's been accomplished in the name of giving and to show that there is still much to do. Charlie Weber, could you explain exactly what the Story County Alliance for Philanthropy is?
Thank you very much. The Story County Alliance for Philanthropy, or I may abbreviate it as SCAP on this call, we look for nominations from different individuals or organizations that have made contributions, whether it's acts of philanthropy or donations throughout the year. This is the 16th year that the organization and the group of nonprofits has existed within Story County.
So does the Story County Alliance for Philanthropy, it's not a funding organization. Its duty is to recognize people, not to give out grants. Is that correct?
Yes, it's to recognize people, and the 16 nonprofits that are a part of the organization all volunteer their time. We do look for sponsors in the community to primarily fund the awards luncheon, which is in November every year.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So no grants.
Your purpose is to acknowledge the importance of philanthropy and the people who are actually doing it.
Yes.
Right? Can you tell us a little bit about where this mission came from? Why was this group put together?
Well, 16 years ago, there was just a recognition, and I'll say, you know, I wasn't involved 16 years ago, but from what I understand, it was United Way, which is one of the 16 organizations, and other nonprofits that all saw activities going on in the community. If you think of United Way and the way they reach out to individuals, businesses, et cetera, there's just a recognition at that point in time. And I think the amazing thing is that they've kept this effort alive over that number of years. It could easily go away without these different organizations deciding to volunteer their time and then sponsors stepping up every year to fund the awards luncheon.
So the effort being the effort to award people who are being generous in the community.
Yes.
The assumption, I guess, is that the reason for doing that is to encourage and reward people for being that way?
Yeah, and I think it provides awareness of what people are doing in the community, And therefore, it sets an example for other people that if other people can do that, I can do that too. And I being either an individual, an organization, a business.
If you were going to give a grade to Story County for its level of philanthropy, what kind of a grade would you give it?
Oh, A plus.
Oh, really?
You know, when we solicit donations in the May-June window, we get a lot of nominations. And, you know, we recognize five of them in the November timeframe, but there's a lot of other people and organizations that could deserve merit and awareness as well.
So sometimes it's hard to choose.
It is hard to choose. Organization has four committees: awards, budget, events, and marketing. And the awards committee probably has the most difficult. I mean, when you look at budget, events, and marketing, that's kind of here's the things I need to go do. The awards group is the ones that have to make decisions out of all the nominations that come in. Five categories.
Of the areas that people get awards in?
So there's an individual, family, a philanthropist, a business, corporate, or foundation. There's an individual volunteer, group volunteer, and a youth volunteer. What's surprising me in the couple years I've been involved is youth volunteers, which could be junior high or high school groups that proactively initiate some activities on their own. So they don't have a lot of financial resources or anything, but they're very inventive in what they can do to help other people.
So the award goes for inventiveness as well. It's not just based on the amount that of money or time is spent. It's also recognition for inventiveness. Is that correct?
Yeah. Awards committee would look at that, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so now you're looking for nominations now, right, for the award ceremony, which will happen in November?
There's three key dates, Ursula. The first one is June 26th, and what we look or request the community to do is to submit nominations for people that fit into those five categories. We then the awards committee collectively looks at that, because many times an organization or individual that's nominated, it's nominated by more than one person or organization. So we kind of consolidate all those, go through some weighting criteria, and then July 31st, or after we've received those on June 26th, for the ones that we decide to process further, we'll then ask for actual nominations where we collect the more systematic information. So that second date is July 31st. And then the actual awards banquet this year, subject to health conditions, but it's scheduled for November 19th. It's always held at Gateway every year. There is a website where individuals that are listening here can go out and look for the nomination process and forms for the intent to nominate. It's www.storycountyphilanthropy.org. I got to tell you, I type this every day, and I still struggle with philanthropy. So I'm going to repeat that and spell it. So it's Story County, PHILANTHROPY.org. You know, you're typing things and it spell checks for you, and you don't always go back and check spell check. That's probably the one word I go back, and I don't believe spell check, so I always make sure I check that one.
And their website will tell you how to nominate somebody, right?
Yes.
Now, does the person that you nominate, do they have to be part of a nonprofit organization, or do they, I mean, what is there any sort of criteria to help the listener, person listening to this, kind of think about who they should be thinking about?
Well, they can think of a junior high student or organization, high school organization. They can think of somebody like Ruth Harris, who's well-known in Ames. Was one award recipient last year. Another winner was REMAX. Another one was Story City Friends Endowment, which is an organization that's existed for many years, Story City being within Story County. Roland Story Community School District was recognized last year. So as far as who you nominate, it can really be an individual or any organization or business. As far as who does the nomination, which very well could be people that are listening today, anyone can provide a nomination. And that's why we do press releases in the newspapers. That's why we get on the radio stations, because we're soliciting true input from the community. We also think this year with the coronavirus pandemic going on, that there's even more examples of what people and organizations are doing in this particular year. So we really expect a lot of nominations and welcome all of them.
One aspect of these awards that is interesting is that you have artworks made in honor of the people who are awarded. Can you explain how that works?
You mentioned at the very beginning that Anna was on the call today as well, and I'm going to let Anna answer that question.
Yeah, so last year I was part of that committee, and Charlie, you did such a great job describing it. And I remember in the last meeting that Gene Cressy, who is the president and CEO of United Way, it is an amazing compliment to Story County and Ames that they have never had to repeat the same artist, that there's so much talent here that a different artist has done the award every year. Last year it was Chris Martin, and I was saying that when I heard it was Chris Martin, I was excited because I thought it was Chris Martin from Coldplay, but it was not, but a very, very talented artist. And so when
yes,
you saw
yes.
the award, yeah. Very, very proud to receive
but
that
Anna,
award.
Anna, can you explain just real quickly, because we have to end in a minute, but what you ask one artist to make an award that represents everybody, or is each person given an artwork, or how does that work?
I believe what happens is that the committee says the spirit of philanthropy or whatever moves you, and then they create the work of art.
And what happens to the work of art?
It goes to each of the award recipients, so they get to display that like an Oscar or a Grammy award in their living room or dining room.
Oh, okay.
First, our website has pictures of those different artworks from most of the different years.
So, yes, I've seen it. It's very beautiful, and very highly esteemed artists. So these artists, they make an artwork, especially for the person who's being awarded, and then that person, it's kind of like instead of a trophy, right? They're given an artwork then that they can take home.
Yes, and each yes. one of the pieces are the same, so it's more of a generic spirit of philanthropy that the artist interprets. And then each recipient gets the same award.
Well, that's really wonderful. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about this. And again, this is Charlie Weber with the Story County Alliance for Philanthropy, and also Anna Magnuson. They're making a call for nominations for people who have been generous in the community. And real quick, run by again what the categories are.
Individual, family, business, corporation, or foundation. The third one is individual volunteer. The fourth one is a group volunteer fundraiser. And the last one is a youth volunteer.
Okay, thank you. And the website is storycountyphilanthropy.org, and that's where you can make your nominations. Thank you so much, Charlie, for joining us.
Thank you, Ursula.
شکوه از تو، غرور از تو، غم دنیا به دور از تو. تو شوق تماشایی، تو بی پروا و زیبایی. دلت دریا، شبت روشن، به نام توست نام من. دیدنی ترین آسمان، ای ستاره باران. زخمی عشقی وطنم، باید صدایت بزنن، باید کنارت بمانم. شعری و شوری وطنم، وقتی صدای تو منم، باید که از تو
مرا با خود ببر آروم به بغض آخرین سنگر به خواب کوچه عاشق به عطر لاله یه قطر تو حس خوب بارانی تو فریاد.
And welcome back to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. You were listening to a Persian song in recognition of Iranian health workers, which comes with a video showing Iranian health workers in the struggle against COVID-19. Iran became one of the first coronavirus hotspots outside of China last March. It has had 142,000 confirmed cases with 7,564 deaths, and it is now being understood in Iran that the numbers are higher because the doctors are seeing a new surge of patients with gastrointestinal problems rather than respiratory problems associated with COVID-19. And this is an important red flag for us as well here in the United States. Gastrointestinal symptoms include acute diarrhea, abdominal spasms, stomach aches, nausea, vomiting, and loss of appetite and smell. And this is affecting children as well as adults. So it's becoming apparent that these symptoms are more common than previously thought, and statistics are not including patients who have these problems instead of respiratory problems. And Iranian medical experts are kind of raising the red flag that patients with milder stomach problems are at risk because they're not getting tested and they can be causing the virus to spread faster. So new information coming in about complications. Anne, are you there?
I am. So welcome, Dr. Jim Ross, Presidential Chair in Veterinary Microbiology and Preventative Medicine and Director of the Center for Food Security and Public Health at Iowa State University.
Thank you, Anne.
So, Dr. Ross, I understand your area of expertise is in food security related to diseases of food-producing animals. My first question to you is, we have a novel virus. How surprised were you that a novel virus could introduce itself so quickly around the world?
Well, there's two components to that question. One is how surprised about a novel virus arising in the human population. And there have been a lot of examples of that in the last 40 years with HIV, West Nile virus, avian influenza, the original SARS, the MERS virus, which are also coronavirus. So we're living in a time where new diseases are emerging, and nearly all of those, or essentially all of those, are transferred from animals to people. So we are seeing a lot of new diseases over the last several years, and we have to expect to continue to see new diseases. Spreading all over the world that quickly is something relatively new due to the extensive transportation of people, international flights, and goods. So it's not too surprising that when, especially a respiratory disease, a new respiratory disease that no one has immunity to arises and then spreads due to the extensive transportation.
Now, when you say these are diseases that are transferring from animals to humans, can you explain to our listeners a little bit about how that happens?
Well, there are a number of reasons. It seems to mostly occur when humans have incursions into areas in large numbers that we didn't used to, especially like tropical areas, rainforests. They can jump from unusual species that we don't usually interact with, like bats, fruit bats, to people. Now, I need to emphasize that COVID jumped probably from bats into people, maybe with an intermediate animal host. But now it's people to people. And there is no concern about COVID in livestock or poultry, and there's no concern about COVID in the meat, milk, or eggs that we consume.
So why is it a bat, or through an intermediate host, or perhaps directly, can infect a human, but it spares poultry, cattle, bovines?
Well, viruses typically are somewhat species-specific. Some are very species-specific and only infect, well, the bat, for example, which does not make the bat sick. But then when it gets into people and starts spreading, viruses can be very specific to people, or as with COVID, we're seeing rare cases in cats and dogs, quite rare. Mink are quite susceptible. Mink farms are having a problem in Europe with this, but no food-producing animals are, fortunately, are affected with this.
So, yeah, let's talk about food and humans. How do you see the coronavirus and the illness that it causes, COVID-19, impacting the food security of, let's say, the United States?
Well, it's having a major impact a couple of different ways. One is, as everybody's probably aware, there have been a lot of cases in workers in meatpacking plants. So our meatpacking plants have had to shut down, many of them, for a period of time to better prepare for this virus, to build in protections for their workers. And they've had to slow down because there aren't enough, they can't have workers as close together as they used to. So our food production has been a just-in-time process where the packing plants for pork and beef have had to operate at nearly full capacity continuously, and that's worked very well to be able to process the number of animals we have. When they've had major slowdowns, then the animals can't get processed. So we have a backlog of beef, poultry, and pigs needing to be processed, and they can't all get processed. So that leads to two things. One is a decrease in price for the farmers because there are too many live animals, and the packing plants don't have to pay as much for them. And there's not enough product for consumers. So the price at the consumer end goes up, the price at the farmer end goes down. And the packing plants have increased expenses because of the need to operate with COVID. The other major problem with food security is all of the people that have lost jobs. So that there's a record unemployment very rapidly in this country and very distressingly, families that can't afford to pay their rent and buy food. And we're seeing a rapid increase in food insecurity in the U.S., and it's worse in many other parts of the world.
So what about other sources of protein? Obviously, we've heard a lot in Iowa about the pork industry. How is this impacting the chicken and or cattle industry? Is this just a question of work at the slaughterhouse, or is there some other way that this is impacting the movement of these products to the grocery shelf?
It's mainly because of slowdown in processing in the livestock industry and poultry industry, that our processing plants are very efficient. They're built to work at capacity. There's not excess capacity because that's expensive to have excess capacity. So it works very well under normal circumstances for many years. But now with the slowdown, it's a bottleneck at processing.
What about other sources of food? For example, I'm a native of the San Joaquin Valley in California, where we also have just-in-time processing of fruits and vegetables. What are your thoughts about how those industries could be impacted as we move into the summer harvest seasons?
I think we've already seen some impacts. A few weeks ago, there was a lot of, there was video of farmers plowing under their green bean harvest and other harvests because there aren't enough workers to harvest the crops. So that's a problem in the fruit and vegetable industry as well, the commercial fruit and vegetable. They depend on very large numbers of workers at just the right time to harvest their crop, get them processed, and to market. So that's
So there's a certain similarity there, though, different food sources. Mm-hmm. How do you see this this virus impacting the United States food supply, say, over the next 6 months to a year?
I think in the United States, we will adapt to it. The packing plants are adapting by installing a lot more safety issues and protocols for their workers. So we're seeing the capacity slowly increasing back towards normal. I don't know that we'll get to normal. And there have been cases of producers having to destroy hogs and poultry that are just building up and cannot be processed. But that's there's a lot of efforts to try and get the system working again so that we can still produce food. I think ongoing, the biggest problem with food security in the U.S. will be people out of work, not able to afford the food that they need.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning of our interview that you were not surprised that a virus could break out like this. What do you think that the world, governments, organizations, corporations, individuals can do in the future to protect ourselves individually and collectively from another event like this? What have we learned?
I think we're in the midst of learning it, and I think it's there are many lessons to learn yet because it could get much worse. I don't see indications that this is going to go away.
Yeah.
I think that the food insecurity problem is going to add to the disease problem. In other countries that aren't as wealthy as the U.S., there's very little social safety net and a lot of unemployment also with not many alternatives. So the people become desperate for food, are less concerned about maintaining social distancing and disease prevention because they're desperate for food. And that is a condition that can lead to bigger outbreaks of COVID-19 and a breakdown of the public health system, which is already fairly weak around the world. And there are other diseases out there that if they emerge under those conditions with without an adequate public health system, an adequate ability of the public to take care of themselves and try and avoid infection, we could see more emerging diseases and emerge more strongly.
Now, is there a role that climate change plays in this?
Yes, it's been, as everyone knows, well, most people know, it's been going on and making a lot of things more difficult. So food production can has to adapt to the climate change that's occurring. And, you know, there are that's a huge other topic. But, yes, it does contribute.
These are all huge topics.
Dr. Roth, this is Ursula. Is Iowa State, are you and Iowa State responding to the crisis currently actively in some way in addressing these issues?
Yes, the university is focusing in many different aspects. There's the local urgent aspect of getting the university opening again safely to serve our students. There's a lot of research interest and activity. We're seeing research opportunities with federal grants being announced that we can apply for. And the veterinary diagnostic lab is working very hard to gear up for testing people for COVID because there's one of the tools we desperately need is testing ability, both to test for infection and antibodies. And that takes a little time to gear up, but our diagnostic lab has a huge capacity for testing for viruses and antibodies in animals. And they can double that capacity for testing people, and they're working very hard to do that as quickly as possible.
Dr. Ross, what are some suggestions you might make to people in our local communities to protect themselves from food insecurity during the time of COVID?
Well, we have the very real problem of people getting sick and dying with COVID. We've just, after 3 months, hit 100,000 people dying in the U.S. and 500 in Iowa. So we desperately need to, for everybody to be responsible, wear masks, social distance. But we also have to open up the economy because there are huge public health problems emerging because of all of the people that are unemployed. And if we're going to protect people from COVID and open the economy, everybody has to take responsibility to protect themselves and protect everyone else. Everyone should be wearing face masks all of the time unless you're all by yourself somewhere. Because face masks, even cloth face masks, have been shown to provide a significant degree of protection, mainly to protect other people, because there's a lot of virus shedding before you develop clinical signs, before you show symptoms, and after symptoms. So we have to be wearing the masks even though we think we're healthy, because we might be shedding the virus and not showing symptoms.
Do the masks provide some protection to the wearer as well?
They provide some protection to the wearer. They are better at stopping virus from somebody who's infected from going out, but they do provide some protection to the wearer.
Well,
we
thank
need
you.
To avoid big gatherings of people.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Jim Ross, Presidential Chair in Veterinary Microbiology and Preventative Medicine and Director of the Center of Food Security and Public Health at Iowa State University. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us today, and we wish you good luck in your future work.
All right. Thank you for having me.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, one of your hosts for the hour, together with Ann Kinzel. Welcome back. Vanessa Baker-Latimer is housing coordinator for the City of Ames, and she has returned together with Susan Guiazda, public relations officer for the City of Ames. Welcome back, guys. Vanessa, you were here recently, and we appreciate you coming back. Susan, before we get started, do you have any announcements from the city?
Yeah, we did have several facility updates that we released yesterday regarding things like city playgrounds and the skate park will open June 1st. Ames Municipal Pool will open as soon as we can. The Furman Aquatic Center will not open for the 2020 season. The Ames ISU Ice Arena is being prepared to open. There's a variety of different decisions that were made at our last council meeting, and those were some of the big ones, but those are not an exclusive list, and I would certainly recommend people check our website at cityofames.org for more information on what specifically is opening and closing, and to be aware that that information still continues to change. So it was a very difficult night for the council, a very long council meeting. And in the end, I keep saying this over and over again, but in the end, they wanted to err on the side of caution, and people's health and safety must be the driving force in making these decisions. And we understand that these are disappointing decisions for many people. But at this point in time, those are the decisions that are made. So
Thank you, Susan.
I wanted to have Vanessa come back because, as you know, the City of Ames did receive some additional federal funding in response to COVID, and Vanessa's been working on various plans and getting a lot of public input to move forward on ways to help and assist Ames citizens.
Well, thank you for coming back, Vanessa Baker-Latimer. We appreciate it. As Susan said, you were here recently speaking about this unexpected funding, and that's what's called the Community Development Block Grant. Is that correct?
Yes, we got a special allocation of the CARES Act funding for COVID-19 through our Community Development Block Grant program.
And you were soliciting input from the community, especially on how to use the need, how to use the money, because obviously there's so many different needs that need that are coming up because of the crisis. Thank you for coming back to report on that. Did you get input?
Oh yes, I got a lot of input, and I really appreciate the public taking time to send me information. I did hear from several groups. I also had Zoom meetings with human service agencies, with lenders, with the medical community, with the business community. And so it was good input. And so from there, we went to City Council and reported on the community input, and also kind of talked about the criteria and the eligible activities that this funding is specifically for, which is all COVID related. And so the decision by council was to approve me proceeding with writing a plan to create a rent utilities, mortgage utilities relief program. So the funding, we got just over $354,000. So that's basically kind of split 50-50 to help bring some relief to both renters and homeowners who were affected by loss of employment or receiving underemployment, to try to help them with those financial needs. And the timing of everything is really kind of stressing, because as of last night at 11:59, the moratorium on evictions ended. So now landlords can start doing their 3-day notice to cure to tenants. However, the Supreme Court's moratorium, the Iowa Supreme Court, let me make that clarification, issuing a forcible entry is not up until June 15th. So I had a conversation with landlords and just kind of communicating with them that, you know, this is probably likely going to impact a lot of people in Ames, and that we are in the process of trying to work on a program to help address some of these needs. And also, we also found out that the governor is also going to create a rent and mortgage assistance program, and that to hang in there, because assistance is coming, and hopefully for tenants not to panic at this point. But as I said initially to the public, if you can communicate with your landlord to enter in some type of payment agreement, even if you pay something towards that, and also for landlords to do the same thing, then we can kind of hopefully get through not having this huge impact of people moving in anticipation of getting an eviction notice. That would just create this big wave of people becoming homeless all of a sudden. If people just, okay, I'm going to get an eviction notice, so I'm just going to go ahead and move now. That's really not the thing to do at this point, and not panic. But again, communication is going to be the key to getting through this process. And there is a number of steps that have to be done. Like I said, I'm trying to finish up the action plan that will go out for public comment starting on Friday. And the comment period, I believe, will end on June 4th. And the public hearing would be on City Council on June 9th.
So, that's Vanessa, if I'm a tenant and I'm having trouble paying rent, and I'm hearing that this special funding is being allocated to help with these problems, can I feel that this may be of assistance to me? And if so, what can I do to put myself in the possibility of getting help?
Again, one of the first things they should do is communicate with their landlord and get into some type of payment agreement and, you know, verify that they were affected by COVID, by loss of job and so forth. And people need to publicly understand that this is specifically COVID related. So if they were having rent issues prior to the act becoming effective back in March 27th, it probably will not cover that. It would be that point forward because it's specifically for the impact of COVID-19.
So how will this allocation of funding directly affect me? The special funding that you're talking about?
Well, if you were impacted by it, by loss of job and had to go on unemployment and did not have enough to cover your jobs, you could make an application and we would determine if you meet the criteria. There's also, and so at this
Where would I make the application?
Well, at this point, we're not doing applications because we have to get the plan submitted to HUD for approval first. And once that's been approved, then we will create an application process where people will be able to submit an application get the application from our website. They can email it in or they'll should be able to fax it in because City Hall is still closed to the public until July.
And what is the website?
www.cityofames.org/housing.
Okay.
So, Vanessa, today's May 28th, and let's say my rent is due June 1st, and I've lost my job for COVID. I contact my landlord, and my landlord says, tough luck. What do I do?
Well, again, the landlords, since the eviction moratorium has lifted, they can still issue you a 3-day notice to cure. And if they have not made a payment arrangement with you, at this point, that's all they can do at this point, because that if they go to the court system, clerk of courts to get something sent to you, the courts are not at this time, it's my understanding, sending out the sheriff's department to do anything at this point until June 15th.
So they can't get a judgment. Do you think you'll have your program in place around June 15th?
I hope so. Guaranteed.
You were almost brought to tears, Vanessa, by the things that you were seeing in our community. How are you feeling now?
I'm still a little overwhelmed by everything because it's like being in the dark without a flashlight, and I'm just trying to find my way through because I'm writing guidelines for a program where the guidelines from the government has not been put out there.
Well, so, Vanessa, I have one good story to share with you. Our landlady, Cindy Jones, here at the Ames Pantorium, she responded to the end of the moratorium by granting us a month rent-free here as a landlady. So we want to really thank Cindy. She's taking her responsibility as a COVID-19 landlady very serious.
And I've heard from a lot of landlords that's really trying to work things out because they know the impact of eviction in their apartment complex could leave them completely empty and still not receiving any funding to reimburse them for the impact that they've had on paying their mortgages and all of those things. So it's a domino effect for everyone. So I just encourage them to hang in there because even the state's program isn't running yet, because not all the guidelines are available from HUD. And so we're all trying to get something up and running, but there's still procedures in place that we have to do before we even get permission to get the funds actually a grant application exactly from HUD.
Well, obviously, you're working as fast as you can, and we appreciate the effort. It's really a monumental effort that's going on to try and rise to the occasion. Thank you so much, Vanessa Baker Latimer. Any last
thank
words?
Thank you for having me.
Pardon me?
I said thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And again, that website is cityofames.org/housing. And it looks like funding is being arranged to help individuals and businesses with their housing. And thank you for the work you're doing. Really appreciate it.
All righty.
Okay. And Anna Banana, you're here, right?
Yes, Anna Banana is here. And in light of recent events, I share the first heart-to-heart message, which is Langston Hughes' poem, I Too, which was published in 1926. I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody will dare me say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I too am America. So when you hear the news, the depths of sorrow, rage, injustice, and ugliness that can weigh heavily on your heart, it can become overwhelming, where you can easily become paralyzed with fear and uncertainty, and you don't know what to do next, how to move forward. But Becky Valakis shared a passage from a woman named Elena Mikhailova, who gives good advice about what to do during hard times, which reads as follows. My grandmother once gave me a tip. In difficult times, you move forward in small steps. Do what you have to do, but little by little. Don't think about the future or what may happen tomorrow. Wash the dishes, remove the dust, write a letter, make a soup. You see, you're advancing step by step. Take a step and stop. Rest a little, praise yourself, take another step, then another. You won't notice, but your steps will grow more and more. And the time will come when you can think about the future without crying. So I want to thank you, Becky, for sharing this with us. We're all trying to figure out what to do now to protect our future. And speaking of future, but ignoring the advice of the previous message to not think about the future, and to end on a lighter note, a colleague found this publication called The Quarantine Times. And in the April edition, it featured letters from children to their future selves, which I thought was such a clever idea. And so here are two of the kids' heart-to-heart messages. This is from Ellie, who's a third grader, who writes to her future self. Dear Ellie, we are in Corona crazy. School has been canceled for a month. All non-essential stores are closed, such as library, playground, Hobby Lobby, grocery stores are open. In the country of Jordan only, the small food stands are open. With me and my family are trading books and games with another family. I'm also trading books with another friend, Lucy. We cannot go in friends' houses to play. Corona crazy is crazy. So that's from Ellie, who's homeschooled. Then the next message comes from Josie, who is a second grader. So Josie writes to her future self, Dear Josie, this time is crazy. I'm going to wonder what my kids are going to ask me about Corona. The quarantine is very stressful. We had Easter on Zoom. I got roller skates and lots of other things. You can't go in friends' houses and you can't play on playgrounds. The things that are closed are Claire's, Hobby Lobby, Sierra Trading, Old Navy, Bed Bath & Beyond, and American Girl. I haven't been at school for a month. We are borrowing books and games because the libraries are closed. I don't want to miss having friends over. I'm about a pen pal with a Noel. I hope I don't forget about Corona. Love, Josie. So those are the two children who are writing to themselves in the future about coronavirus. And I think it's funny. They're both are very concerned that Hobby Lobby was closed. So they're probably happy because Hobby Lobby is now open. But this also reminded
I think Anna Bed Bath. I think Bed Bath & Beyond it closed for good.
Yeah, some of those places are closed. So that's definitely an impact. And so those children are quite concerned about it and have documented it, which reminded me of the Iowa State University storytelling project that we learned about in Local Talk a couple weeks ago and the importance of documenting our stories of how we get through this pandemic. And KHOI certainly has an important role and documenting our community stories and how we're living through these very strange times. So, Ursula, you started today's show with a message from Mr. Murphy about the spirit and act of caring by wearing masks. Charlie Weber came on and shared information about the Story County Alliance for Philanthropy and a call for nominations. And philanthropy literally means the love of mankind, love of humankind. And I think about, and Susan Guiasta came on to talk about some of the closings and things that are not going to continue or will open up again. And while we are disappointed by closing or delays of openings of facilities, it can get you down, and even though you understand why this is the case. But Anna Banana today, in these heart-to-heart messages, is asking you, all of us, to be kind, to be fair, to be just, and love each other. So thank you, Becky, and thank you to the friend who shared the Quarantine Times link for sharing these heart-to-heart messages. And if you'd like to respond to any of these messages or want to share what is in your heart with us, I invite you to call or text Anna Banana at 515-809-0077, or you can always email me at khoiradio@gmail.com and put heart-to-heart in the subject line, please. So thank you for listening to these individual heart-to-heart messages that connect us to a community of love, care, and support that is KHOI, the heart of Iowa, which is you and me.
Thank you, Anna Banana. We appreciate it, as always. And you've been listening to Local Talk. We've been your hosts, Ann Kinzel, and myself, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for being with us for the past hour. Local Talk was engineered by Mike Murphy and produced with the help of Lynn Carey and Susan Guiasta. You may have received an email from KHOI recently asking for support. If you're not a member donor, you most likely did not receive it, so I'd like to take a moment to share with you what was said. As COVID-19 changed all of our lives, we at KHOI knew we could either face the new challenges head-on or risk losing the station completely. So we assumed a can-do attitude and went to work here at KHOI. Here is some of what we discovered we can do. Continue to operate 24/7 by embracing new technologies. Meet emerging community needs by adding COVID-19 related programming. Maintain the familiar in a time of uncertainty by continuing to offer regular local programs. And seek crisis related funding through grants and loans. What we know we can't do is we can't survive, let alone thrive, without your support. We must enlist your help to keep KHOI's unique and essential services on the air. In order to keep everyone safe, we were unable to proceed with spring fundraising plans that we had. Our heart-to-heart fundraising event has been indefinitely postponed, and our traditional on-air drive was unable to occur as planned. Local businesses have had to reduce their underwriting budgets. Grants and loans are only stopgap measures. So we are critically in need of funding to continue broadcasting, and we are well aware that there has been widespread economic disruption caused by the pandemic, but we really need you to step up and contribute. Please be generous. The financial support of our members and donors is crucial, as always, so please consider giving $150 if you can. But we would be grateful for whatever you can provide. Sincerely, your KHOI family. And the easiest way to donate to KHOI is to go to khoifm.org and use the big yellow donate button to make a safe donation online. Thank you.
Yes, and thank you for spending the hour with us today. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. You can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org and find links to our interesting guests and information you heard during the program. Also, remember that KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kay Chelly. You also heard from a Persian tribute to Iranian healthcare workers, and Nimbus by Ralph Towner. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for supporting the station. Thank you for listening. And we will see you again on the radio.